you really and truly will feel it is okay and no longer be haunted by worry. Another is that absolving wrongdoers is an act of kindness that allows them a fresh start to try to do better. And of course, there are those who believe that absolution allows for the slate to be wiped clean for everyone involved. Obviously, I don't agree with this. If something truly horrible was done, saying it's okay won't make it disappear, and in a lot of cases, I don't want wrongdoers to have a fresh start. I want them to think long and hard every day about what they did wrong and feel remorse. Jolenta, for her part, feels this even more strongly than I do. Do not cross Jolenta. Now, let's talk about the gratitude version of forgiveness. Should we be thankful for everything that's made us who we are today? Proponents of this model say yes, because surviving adversity means we can relate to other people who've survived adversity. It also means we can tap into more complex parts of ourselves. But I think there are limits to this idea. Yes, some adversity can make us more empathetic and nuanced in our thinking, but then take that adversity up a level, and I'm not so sure. Is it really making a person better or worse? Frankly, I wouldn't wish some of the abuse I've faced on anyone, much less my younger self. I'm not grateful for it at all. And for all the supposed good things forgiveness proponents will say I gained from it, I can name dozens of bad things I also gained, from confusion about healthy expressions of love to demented ideas about my own worth, things that took me years of counseling to come to terms with. And Jolenta sure as hell isn't grateful for the abuse she's suffered either. Finally, let's talk about understanding. If we try to understand the people who've done us wrong, will we be happier? If we see their bad behavior as the result of bad things that they had to live through, will that bring us peace? In some cases, I think this can be true. For example, if someone, hypothetically speaking, steals a loaf of bread from my store because they're desperate and hungry, those are circumstances I can understand and forgive. If someone bounces a couple small checks to me because they were brought up with absolutely no understanding of money management, I can forgive that. And if a person's transgressions are nonviolent, I can also usually enlist my understanding. But for me, it stops there. I would never expect a rape survivor to try to understand her assailant's point of view. I think it's downright cruel when people think rape survivors should. And my feelings on this go both ways. Just as I would never extend understanding to a child predator, I wouldn't expect others to draw on their understanding if the predator was me. I wouldn't want them to say, "Hey, she was treated badly growing up. It was inevitable she'd hurt someone else." Growing up in a lousy situation doesn't give a person carte blanche to pay it forward. And while some people choose to continue a cycle of abuse, the vast majority of us don't. Passing it on is not an inevitability. Now, at this point, you may be thinking, "Holy smoky, Kristen is a cold-hearted, unforgiving monster. She sure must be unhappy with all that bitterness in her heart." And to that, I say, surprise! I'm actually super happy. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I have a song in my heart and a spring in my step, and more often than not, I have a jolly smile on my face. I have close friends like Jolenta and beloved family members and my dear husband who would drop anything and everything to help me in a moment of need. They all have. I see beauty in the world every day. I am the opposite of bitter. And no, I don't carry around the pain of my past like an albatross. I'm not dragging around a ball and chain of rage. I don't feel I'm being held hostage by past trauma. I don't feel I'm held back in any way by my refusal to forgive certain things or people. As my friend and founding By the Book producer Cameron Drews once wisely said, there are a lot of options between unconditional forgiveness and burdened misery. We don't have to choose one or the other. Indeed, we can choose not to wish any happiness on the people who've done us wrong and live happy lives. We can choose not to feel grateful to the people who've hurt us and be grateful for the lives we have. And we can choose to have some anger in our hearts toward those who've abused us and still have hearts that overflow with joy. The world is filled with in-betweens. And I honestly believe life is better when we don't force ourselves to live on the extreme ends. If you want to, go ahead. But I, for one, don't want to, and I feel at peace. Unforgiving heart and all.
Dear Kristen and Jolenta, but when you don't forgive, you're really only punishing yourself. I beg you both, please forgive for your own sake. RH. Dear RH, I'm sorry, but I think I disagree with you. I've tried the pure forgiveness route, And it has worked with small things. Mostly it works well with people I trust. That core group that I know have my back no matter what, because our relationship is based on a solid foundation of love and honest communication. But this doesn't work when I truly think someone has hurt me with malicious or blindly selfish intent. And especially if that's the only side of them they've ever chosen to share with me. Perhaps I'm not as generous as you when it comes to giving perpetrators the benefit of the doubt, but I have found that voicing my story, defining it in my terms, identifying how I was hurt by a person or situation, and being as specific as possible are what have helped me work through the often punishing feelings that resentment leads to. For me, finding my voice and using it to retell my version of events and explore how I've held on to this pain, causing myself years of residual damage, is way more healing than feeling obligated to play nice when it's not in my heart to do so. Jolenta. Aim to have it all. The most basic thing about me is definitely my wedding. On paper, it's the one time in my life I appeared to have it all. But I assure you, I did not have it all, because having it all isn't real. My wedding truly did look like a magical hipster bullshit fairy tale brought to life. It was so idyllic, it was like Pinterest became a sentient monster and walked the earth. It stomped around, barking orders like, "Succulents must be in all the bouquets." All the groomsmen will wear leather suspenders so they look old-timey. And my personal favorite, the ring bearer shall be the bride's senile childhood dog. On the outside, I was killing it. I was a wedding planning beast. But I was conflicted. The deeper I got into planning my wedding, the more grossed out I became by the whole wedding industry. It's an insult to women, a hugely lucrative scheme to capitalize on the idea that you finally found someone to love you. I found it hard to be a passionate feminist and still care about how the wood grain on the tree stump candle holders looked. And it's super hard to be a feminist and also ask your parents to spend thousands of dollars so you can publicly declare the fact that you're going to try your hardest to bone one person for the rest of your life. But I wanted to have it all. And that meant making this promise to bone this one guy forever while dressed like a pretty, pretty princess. Do you guys know how hard it is to become a dang princess? So hard. And not very feminist feeling at all. I demeaned myself on the regular to become a princess. I stood naked on a tarp in a woman's basement while I paid her to airbrush a tan onto every inch of my skin. I sat for 2 hours while a woman taped my eyes shut and glued fake eyelashes one by one to my face. And on top of all that, I forced myself to give up carbs for 6 months. This was a big mistake. My stomach was like, "What are you doing to me? I don't know who I am without carbs. I shall curse you with constant diarrhea." Seriously, if you Google carb-free living plus diarrhea, you'll find many a forum post that says, "Oh yeah, it's totally normal." On an intellectual level, I knew this could not be right. Eating healthy should not turn your poo liquid. But I was determined to have it all on my wedding day, and if barfing out my ass was the only way to do that, then so be it. Because I'm a feminist, and feminists deserve to have it all, even if having it all is often defined by outdated sexist and classist ideals. You see why I was so conflicted? This kind of stuff is hard to reconcile. Part of the reason I was determined to have a blog-worthy wedding was that Brad and I do not have a fairy tale story. We were messy. We were on and off friends with benefits for a year, and after we started dating, our love was still sloppy. How sloppy? Well, one evening over a quiet dinner at home during our engagement, I noticed a big old blackhead just begging to be squeezed. I'm obsessed with picking zits and blackheads, so needless to say, I very much wanted at that bad boy on Brad's neck. I must make it mine. But this blackhead was off limits. I wasn't allowed to pick anything on him because, according to him, it hurts and feels disrespectful. But I wanted this blackhead bad. It was a perfect specimen, the nice, big kind that can easily be mistaken for a freckle. I knew it was going to be so satisfying to pop. So I asked real nice, "Hey, buddy, you got a real bad blackhead on your neck. How about I do you a favor and get rid of it for you?" "No," he dryly responded. "I'll do the dishes if you let me," I was starting to get desperate now, and offered to do chores he normally took care of. "No," he said again without looking up from his dinner. "I'll do the laundry?" Still no. I decided to go all in with my final offer. "I'll suck your dick." And with that, Brad silently stopped eating his meal and slowly leaned his head forward to present his neck. I went to town on that blackhead, and it popped like a dream. And the second I was done with my pop, Brad sat up straight and whipped his junk out at the table, and I followed through on my end of the bargain because I am a woman of my word. Now, you're probably thinking, "Jolenta, you're disgusting. Why are you telling me this?" You're right. I am gross. Just as gross as my fiancé. Together, we are two gross garbage people who trade popped blackheads for a blowjob. That is the kind of messy lovebirds we were mere months before we said our vows. No wonder I felt like my ethereal Lauren Conrad wannabe, woodland-themed hipster nuptials and my pretty princess bod were a veil of lies draped over the pell-mell, uncensored vibe of myself and my relationship. My picture-perfect wedding was fueled by Pinterest standards and diarrhea. It was gorgeous, but it just didn't feel like it really represented who we were. And because of that, the day felt a bit more hollow and a smidge less special than I expected. My wedding story illustrates a greater theory I'm forming about the idea of having it all. I'm learning that appearing to have it all externally is nothing compared to fulfilling your actual dreams. Thus, any book laying out concrete directions on how to have it all is probably full of hot air. There are lots of books out there like this. Kristen and I have lived by plenty of them, and they've all left us feeling unsatisfied and inadequate. In Girl, Wash Your Face, Rachel Hollis implies that having it all is defined by working with rich people and having enough money for designer purses and living in a stereotypical straight family unit with a gaggle of kids by the time you're 30. This very basic ideology led to frustratingly simple advice to live by for Kristen and me. But instead of feeling empowered, I felt bummed out because I was living by advice that was just another reminder of the fact that my goals don't always match up with society's expectations of me. Randy Zuckerberg's book, Pick Three, was another we live by that was centered on the idea of having it all. Randy, the older sister of Mark Zuckerberg, is a Harvard graduate. She worked as the director of communications at Facebook, started her own media company, started a family, wrote a book, and even starred in a Broadway musical. In her book, Zuckerberg describes how one of the hardest moments of her life, getting into Harvard as a drama nerd and not a more well-rounded student, taught her that having lopsided priorities can help you appear to have it all. Relatable, right? Zuckerberg believes she's so successful because she's still using that lopsided focus of hers. Rather than trying to do it all every day, she chooses only three areas in her life to focus on and do to the best of her abilities. That way, she can have it all, just not every day. Living by this advice drove Kristen and me nuts. Kristen was especially bothered by the way Zuckerberg advises readers to categorize the people in their lives into friends and family, then says you should choose strategically who to make time for. Kristen considers her friends to be family, and so do I. How are we supposed to break them up into a sort of A team and B team? Kristen also really struggled with how Randy made sleep a category, and it was one of the things she would choose from every day when she picked her three things to focus on. Think about this. She's definitely not picking sleep every day if it's one of many rotating choices, is she? What? Sleep is a priority only a few times a week? How is that cool or healthy? Kristen would posit that it is neither. There was no room for spontaneity when we lived by pick three, and that was a big issue for both Kristen and myself. Every task we took on was related to making it look like we had it all. But it turned out we didn't want the all we were being instructed to strive for. I don't know about you, but I don't have to want a name brand job. I don't need four kids before I turn 33 to be a success. And I was disheartened to learn how many advice books push women to accept the burden of finding the balance between appearing to be 100% devoted to family and 100% devoted to career at the same time. This is an impossible task. I wish more books would talk about how the notion of having it all keeps women down and saddles us with double the expectations and obligations of those who aren't determined to have it all. Implementing endless life hacks that give the illusion of balance will never ease the dissatisfaction that comes from being in a system rigged against you. Doing it all, having it all, being a pretty, pretty princess on your wedding day. The more I explore these vague goals, the more I feel they exist to distract those of us who can't afford to pay to have it all by advising us to live up to impossible standards that we'll never meet. Any book that idealizes this trap can go bye-bye, as far as I'm concerned. So if you ever come across advice like this in your reading adventures, feel free to put that book down. Your energy is far better spent figuring out what all means to you than aiming to be what someone else's basic-ass version of having it all should look like.
Dear Kristen and Jolenta, I'm not saying anyone else should aim to have it all, but I personally want to. I want the loving spouse and adorable kids and fulfilling job and supportive friends and nice house and smoking hot body. What's so wrong with wanting it all? GM. Dear GM, feel free to aim for what you want. We're not going to stop you. But we also don't want you to feel as though it's your fault if you never get it all, or if you get it only after decades of toil and setbacks. The fact is, fulfilling careers don't usually happen overnight. Likewise with loving relationships and supportive friendships. These all take time, effort, sacrifices, and their fair share of frustrations. As for the other items on your list, these require money. Nice houses cost money. The clothing and feeding of adorable children cost money. Childcare costs money if you want to continue working in that fulfilling career. But let's say, despite the obstacles, you really do manage to get it all. If you do, congratulations. You're living your dream. We just ask you one favor. Please don't look down at all the other people who haven't achieved what you have. Very few people, outside the well-to-do and well-connected, get all they want in the time frame in which they want it. And it may also be the case that all those other people who haven't achieved what you have actually never wanted to. There's a good chance they had different dreams than you. Kristen. P.S. We don't even know what you mean by smoking hot body, but trust us when we say all bodies are beautiful, including yours, when you're feeling neither smoking nor hot. The Law of Attraction. Once upon a time, there was a little boy who dreamed of becoming an astronaut. In all his spare time, the boy shot off bottle rockets and drew pictures of space shuttles and built model airplanes. He read books about space exploration and watched movies that took place on other planets. And with his friends, he'd play games that took place in an imaginary version of the outer limits. As the boy grew older, he took classes in aeronautics and physics. He visited air and space museums. He conducted his own science experiments at home and in the classroom. He even learned to fly a plane. And throughout his life, from the time he was 4 years old, this boy would dedicate large portions of his mental energy to his space fantasies. He daydreamed about life on other planets. He fell asleep picturing himself exploring those planets, and he talked to all who would listen about his hopes of spending time in outer space. Day after day, and year after year, both this boy's heart and his actions were committed to his astronaut dreams. Surely, there was no other child as dedicated to the idea of space travel as this boy was. And friends, you will likely not be surprised in the slightest to learn the outcome of this story. The young boy, who dreamed all his life of going to space, eventually grew up to program computers. That boy is my husband. He loves his work and his life. And no, he is not an astronaut. Now, the law of attraction, which I'm emphasizing only for the sake of believers who always treat it like an official thing, would dictate that my husband absolutely should be an astronaut at this point in his life. According to its logic, thoughts inevitably become things. In the simplest of terms, think a good thing and it will come true, think a bad thing and it will also come true. The wordier explanation of the law of attraction goes something like this. 1. People and their thoughts are made from energy. 2. Like energies attract like energies. 3. Thus, if you put out negative thoughts into the universe, you'll attract negative things. Likewise, if you put out positive thoughts into the universe, you will attract positive things. So, if you think you can be rich, you will be rich. If you think your cancer will disappear, it will. If you think you can be a TV star, have a bodacious booty, and be wildly famous, you will become Kim Kardashian. On the flip side, if you are poor, the law of attraction dictates that you brought your poverty on yourself by thinking poor thoughts. If you have cancer, it's because you attracted cancer to yourself with your cancerous mindset. If your grandpa died in the Holocaust, he was asking for it with his negative energy. Obviously, Jolent and I, being mostly logical people, consider this law a load of hogwash. First and foremost, it assumes that people and their individual thoughts exist in vacuums. But if this is the case, why are Black men 21 times more likely to be victims of police violence in the United States than white men? Is this because all Black men are coincidentally all thinking at the same time, I really want and deserve to be beaten up by cops? More likely, it's because we live in a nation with a 400-year history of slavery, Jim Crow laws, unwarranted mass incarceration, institutionalized racism, legal segregation, and negative depictions of Black men in the media. To take things in the opposite direction, let's look at all the filthy, rich white men in America who hold most of our public offices and corporate leadership positions. Did all of these men reach their positions of power because, by coincidence, they all just happened to be visualizing money and power at the same time and with more intensity than anyone else for the past 400 years? More likely, it's because these men benefited from generational wealth, social capital, and all the same systems that hurt the Black men I just mentioned. Nonetheless, a number of self-help books claim that the law of attraction is as real as the law of gravity. Author after author, from Jen Sincero of You Are a Badass to Rhonda Byrne of The Secret, insist that their own accomplishments in life come down to their wealth-generating and health-attracting thoughts. Now, to be clear, I think it's great to have uplifting thoughts. When things aren't going my way, I try to remind myself that I still have a lot to be thankful for. Jolenta spins her bad moments into funny stories that fill the world with laughter. We both do our best to tap into our optimism. But have my happy thoughts stopped me from having ill health and job losses? Have Jolenta's funny stories prevented her from being sexually harassed? Have they prevented those nearest and dearest to me from dying too young? No. Plenty of lousy things have happened to Jolenta and me, despite my happy mindset and her awesome storytelling. The fact is, the law of attraction is a bunch of hooey. And yet, it's something we hear about again and again in self-help books and pop culture and in the memoirs of rich, successful people. Of course it is. That's because, for those who've made it to the top, including best-selling self-help authors, the law of attraction provides reassurances that the top is where they deserve to be. It creates a framework for the universe in which winners can say, "I won because I had the winningest attitude." It allows people who have the most advantages in life to completely ignore their advantages and instead believe everything they have came to them because of the force of their own will. And it gives successful people permission to blame those who are less successful in life for their failings. In so many ways, the world would be a fantastic place if the law of attraction were true. Innocent children wouldn't be dying in famines. Jolenta and I would have zero experiences with smarmy men. My husband would be an astronaut. But it's not. And as long as people continue to pin all their hopes on this fake law, they'll also be giving themselves permission to ignore both the real ways that bad things are consistently allowed to happen and the hard work that must be done for good things to be more equitably distributed.
Dear Kristen and Jolenta, let's be real. The law of attraction is just a rebranding of the power of positive thinking, and that's not a bad thing. I think life is better when we think positively. Isn't positivity what you're always lauding when you talk about gratitude and positive self-talk? CF. Dear CF, positivity rocks. It's the best. I highly recommend positive self-talk, finding gratitude, and spreading the love. But here's my question. How is declaring the benefit of looking on the bright side a scientific law the same thing as positivity? Believing there is a supernatural law akin to gravity that can help me manifest money with my thoughts and blames me if I get sick because I must have been sending bad vibes out into the universe is not at all like trying to have a positive outlook, right? Jolenta.
Part 3. 8 Things We Wish More Books Recommended. Stop comparing yourself to others. Back when I was a wee lass in the single digits, I remember playing beauty shop with some of the other little girls in my neighborhood. We brushed bright pink blush across our cheeks and agreed that we all looked magnificent. We applied shimmery lipstick to our little mouths. Beautiful. And then it came time for the vibrant blue eyeshadow we'd all been excited about. We took turns applying it, and then, looking around at one another, my little white friends asked why the shadow looked so weird on my sister and me. Notably, both my sister and I are Asian. Now, let me make clear. I think there's nothing wrong with noticing the ways that we're different. I love that we're all different. And pretending not to see our differences, claiming to be colorblind, exclaiming, "There's only one race, the human race," all these things do more to erase than honor our uniqueness. That being said, pointing out that a difference is weird can feel like a real bummer to a kid, or an adult for that matter. It takes a difference and applies a good, bad value to it, when in fact, there's no such thing as an inherently good or bad physical trait, only subjective societal values projected on those traits based on the trends and times. But of course, my little white friends, with their limited vocabularies and limited worldviews, simply saw our differences as weird. And how could they not? After all, almost every aspect of our culture, from our illustrated children's books, to the actors we saw on television, to the models on the covers of magazines at the grocery store, to the packages of our prepared foods, presented a single image of what was normal and what was beautiful. And that was a white woman with a folded upper eyelid as opposed to an Asian woman with no eyelid fold at all. Immersed in our homogenous white culture, it was almost inevitable that at their tender ages, our little friends would see my sister and me as weird. And suddenly, I did too. Occasionally, and then more and more frequently, I began comparing my physicality to others around me, always placing my differences in the bad category. I noticed I had a very long torso and short, muscular legs, while all my white friends seemed to have the opposite proportions. I noticed that my clothes didn't fit me the way they fit my white friends. I noticed that my skin was darker than that of almost everyone else I knew. Of course, the agony that comes from comparison isn't just about race. Jolenta, who is white, felt it very deeply herself growing up. For most of her childhood, she was painfully aware of the fact that she was the least affluent person in a very affluent school. She was almost always the tallest, biggest, and bustiest girl in a sea of waspy, button-nosed pixies. She couldn't wear the same clothes as her female classmates without being called inappropriate by her disgusting PE teacher. Getting out of the compare and despair mindset is hard, especially when we're taught it at such a young age. And frankly, I can't think of a single self-help book we've lived by that's deeply and thoroughly explained why we should. If anything, they've indirectly and sometimes directly suggested that comparison is the ticket to a better life. For example, in You Are a Badass, Jen Sincero suggests we surround ourselves with people who are more successful than we are, with the understanding that their greatness will rub off on us. But in order to do that, we obviously must first compare ourselves to everyone around us and ask, who's doing better than I am? Who's doing worse? How do they all compare to one another? How do I compare to them? There are flaws in this kind of thinking. Among these flaws, the presumption that there's a single definition of more versus less, and by extension, good versus bad, rich versus poor, successful versus failing, and so on. But that's simply not true. For me, a dream life centers on lots of fantastic friends, plenty of great adventures, my dear husband, and storytelling in some form or another. For Jolenta, the dream life includes many of these same things, but also her dog, Frank, her husband, not mine, and plenty of downtime in her cozy Brooklyn apartment. Meanwhile, mainstream entertainment is trying to sell us McMansions, giant lawns, sports cars, Ivy League degrees, expensive jewelry, and 2.5 children. Anyone playing the old comparison game might conclude that my dream life and Jolenta's life are worse than the McMansion life. But we know they're not. Screw comparison, if that's what comparison's verdict is going to be. And let's be real. Our comparison methods tend to be faulty. Appearances can be deceiving. And even if people look like they have the life we want, they don't necessarily. And even if they do, it's possible they went through horrible things to get it. Alternatively, they may have had it all handed to them. Regardless, they didn't have to live my life, and if they did, would they be where they are? I'm guessing not. I'm also guessing that plenty of people with dream lives aren't happy all the time. Even beautiful people feel bad about themselves sometimes, and plenty of people who look like they have it all go home to cheating spouses, debt collectors, and a sense of hopelessness about where their lives are going. As my friends in the AA community say, don't compare your insides to other people's outsides. Add to that Sophia Amoruso's mantra, don't compare your hustle to their highlight reel. An especially useful thing to remember if you're someone who tends to take Instagram and Facebook feeds at face value. Personally, I'm happiest when I'm not comparing myself to others. As Teddy Roosevelt famously said, comparison is the thief of joy. Why rob myself of joy? Why not instead embrace and revel in all the uniquely good things in my life? And when unhappiness strikes, as it inevitably will from time to time, why not focus on how to help myself rather than go down a woe-is-me rabbit hole of comparing myself to others? Isn't it better to see a therapist, talk with friends, go on a walk, map out a list of places I'd like to visit, read a good book, or do something else constructive? Anything is better than comparing and despairing. Of course, saying don't compare yourself to others is easier than doing it. And all the logic and all the action in the world can sometimes still not be enough to pull us out of the throes of comparison. And when that happens to me, I have one last weapon I enlist. I take a moment to think back to little me and all the other small children in the world who are being told they look weird or abnormal in that blue eyeshadow or striped swimsuit or flesh-colored Band-Aid or what have you. I think back to teen Jolenta being told her clothes were inappropriate because her body didn't fit a certain teacher's ideal. I think of all the good, bad binaries our younger selves were fed, binaries that placed thin, rich, white people on one side and fat, brown, poor people on the other. And then I cut it out. I'm a good person, and I know you are too. We don't need to compare ourselves to anyone. We are all beautiful and worthy of love as we are.
Dear Kristen and Jolenta, do you hate straight white men? With some regularity, you mention how easy straight white men have it. We don't all have it easy. I grew up in a blue-collar family, and not all the world's problems are my fault. AZ. Dear AZ, we don't hate all straight men. We're actually both married to straight white men. It's wild. But we do hate straight white men who write books telling women and minorities to live their lives as though they also have it just as easy as straight white men. Annoyingly, many self-help authors are white, male, and heterosexual, and often they write as though everyone experiences the world the way they do, from the top of the societal power structure. As long as authors account for societal inequities and acknowledge that sexism and racism and other concepts that promote inequality are actual forces in the world that no amount of solo, early morning gratitude journaling can dismantle, we're cool with anyone. We're not cool with the ones who don't account for walks of life they can't relate to, and most of those are dudes of the straight and white variety. Jolenta. Check in with your feelings. I have a secret to tell you guys. Acting schools are nuts. Seriously, they have a very cult-like vibe. They tell you that everything you think and believe is a lie. They break you down and they rebuild you using their logic and teachings. On top of that, they really stress the fact that you have no time for your family or friends anymore because you're following the true way. You are pursuing art. So that's pretty culty. In 2008, I was fresh out of university, and instead of entering the workforce during the second coming of the Great Depression, I took the little savings I had that wasn't lost in the stock market and moved from San Francisco to New York to go to a conservatory acting program. I was a perfect candidate for acting school. I loved theater, had no real acting technique, and had no idea who I was. These qualities left me vulnerable and desperate for guidance. I was just a lost little girl who wanted to spend her last few dimes on a place to call my own where someone would tell me how to think. So when I found myself in New York at a slightly prestigious acting conservatory, I was totally ready to have my brain washed. Lucky for me, I was about to be brainwashed with some very good advice. The best part of acting school and the most effective brainwashing tool was the feedback. Basically, all we did was rehearse scenes, perform them for our classmates and instructors, and then get ripped apart by critiques from everyone. The feedback started simple. After my first scene, I was told by my instructor, "Your posture is horrible." And a classmate chimed in to add, "She must have really low self-esteem because she won't root herself to the ground." For 2 years, the feedback I received was basically the same. I'm not owning my space. I'm not rooted to the earth. Still don't know what that means. I'm not harnessing my power. I roughly translated this to, you are a rootless bitch who hates yourself and you can't even cry. Crying is incredibly important in acting school. Everyone who has ever been to acting school will say it's not about learning how to cry, but this is a lie. You are basically a failure unless you can start crying at the drop of a hat. After a lifetime of undiagnosed ADHD, which often led to emotional outbursts, and a childhood spent with a father who has trouble with empathy, I had learned how to do what I call locking it down. Because my emotions were so big and so often misunderstood, I spent a lot of time getting in trouble for reacting emotionally. So instead of checking in with how I felt whenever anything went down, I tried to simply dismiss or ignore my feelings. I'd squelch my feelings and tell myself I was being irrational. Locking it down is a great defense mechanism, but it leaves you tearless. And to be a full card-carrying member of the cult that is acting school, I had to cry. One day, I was in the respite that was voice class, and all it asked of me was to do yoga poses and work on breathing. And yes, people often cry in voice class, but it's not required. You aren't a failure if you don't cry. In this class, we were doing Fitzmaurice work, which requires you to train your body to sort of tremble while you do different yoga poses until your body is shaking and convulsing as though you're having a very intense orgasm. While your body is doing all this, your breath is supposed to fully release or something like that. While in this class, I was in a position known as camel, doing my thing, and my voice instructor came over. She's a fabulous former dancer who has an edgy Zen vibe, and she was coaching me. This simply means she asked to touch me in various places to help me release my voice and said things like, breathe into your knees, breathe into your shoulder, and so on. When she got to my sternum and lightly touched it, something strange happened. It felt like a hot ball of molten lava had formed in my chest, exploded, and sent a wave of searing magma through my body. And I started to cry. Once I started crying, I couldn't stop. I cried all the time. I cried when I ate. I cried when I was in the shower. I'd cry as I fell asleep. As I cried, memories flashed through my mind. Every time I felt ashamed for being too sensitive. Every time my heart had been broken, every loss, every time I self-destructed, I cried all the tears I had tried to lock away. It took weeks to stop crying. I had a lot to make up for, apparently. When I was finally done, I felt like a new woman. I was lighter and brighter, I stood up taller, and I became a much better actor and human being in general. Once I got in touch with where I'd been hiding my emotions, I could finally access them, check in with them, and communicate them to others. I'm forever grateful for that day in voice class and the ridiculous, shaky yoga pose that helped me find my feelings again. Turns out feelings are super important. They're like a barometer for how well a situation is meeting our needs. When our feelings barometer starts to beep, is that what barometers do? We get to pause and figure out what we want to better have our needs met. What's not to like about feelings? So many books, Kristen and I have lived by, paint a picture of the optimal human as someone who has the ability to choose positive feelings over those yucky ones, with the end goal being a life that appears to be free from negative emotions. That book I mentioned earlier that tells readers to admit they're liars, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, is a perfect example of this. In his book, Mark Manson says the first step towards living your best life is to take responsibility for everything that occurs in your life, regardless of who is actually at fault. The book says we should do this because even though plenty of things are beyond our control, we can always control how we react and read into them. This is a great idea in theory, but hard to actually implement, considering emotions are natural and very hard to control human reactions that we use to communicate with others and ourselves. So overriding your feelings or negating them seems kind of counterproductive, right? It was for Kristen and me. We found it to be frustrating and in no way life-enhancing to try to gaslight ourselves. Most of the books we've encountered while living by the book do not touch on the fact that you have to check in with your emotions to even know if you're happy and learn what bums you out. Why on earth would you try to push these natural and helpful indicators away? I don't think it really matters how you get at your emotions as long as you find a way to listen to them and let them run their course. For me, it was that voice class and doing orgasm mimicking Fitzmaurice work. I hope that for you, it doesn't have to be such a production, but even if it does, who will really care? Over the past few years, I've learned that the less energy I waste on trying to change my natural emotional responses to the things life throws at me, the more content I am. And as a bonus, I have more energy left to get myself through emotional situations using less wacky means, such as watching the birds outside my window and speed walking through Manhattan. There are so many great ways to check in with yourself and honor your emotions, like crafting or swimming or even therapy. I'd rather try that stuff than attempt to convince myself my feelings aren't real and end up crying for 2 weeks straight after an ex-modern dancer touched my sternum again.
Do things in chunks. I have a confession. I am a world-class procrastinator. From the time I was in middle school until right this very minute, I've always put things off, pushed things back, and found excuses to do just about anything other than the task at hand. Is a script due tomorrow? In that case, I'll spend today trying on all my spring dresses to see which ones still fit from last year. Do I have a meeting to prepare for this afternoon? If so, I'll spend the next hour working on my social media. And don't get me started on an arbitrary giant project that must be completed from home. I'll spend all day watching reruns of Little House on the Prairie and eating corn chips until I'm forced to stay up all night working on it. This isn't to say that I don't meet my deadlines. I always do, and often my work is good enough for me to be proud of. Sometimes it even wins awards. But I know for a fact that I wouldn't get things done at the last minute or otherwise without a few strategies. First and foremost, I think about those who are counting on me and who will be let down if I don't pull my weight and complete my tasks. Being accountable and filled with guilt helps me get things done. Second, I remind myself that done is better than perfect. Knowing that I don't have to write a Nobel-worthy invoice or the best memo of all time keeps me from perfectionist-driven procrastination. But of course, both these strategies are more about mindset than about action. When it comes to action, I have one big rule. Stop looking at the big picture and instead do things in chunks. Now, I know this is contrary to what a lot of self-help books say. Most books Jolent and I have lived by have encouraged us to look at the big picture. Keep our eyes on the prize. Consider the whole rather than the parts. Focus on our long-term goals. Or draw up a 10-year plan. These books argue that considering the whole will keep us motivated, and looking at the big picture will keep things in perspective. But when it comes to the day-to-day aspects of life and to getting things done, this advice has done more to paralyze me than motivate me. Chunking does the opposite, and I have dozens of ways to do it. One way I chunk tasks is by setting a time limit. I'll say to myself, for example, you only have to fold laundry for 3 minutes. You don't have to commit to doing it forever. More often than not, I'll find that once I get over the hurdle of sitting down with the laundry, I'll fold for longer than 3 minutes. Usually, I'll fold the whole basket. Inertia takes over. But even if it doesn't, I'll know I did more than I would have if I hadn't set that 3-minute time limit in the first place. Getting Things Done by David Allen is one of the few books we've come across that has a similar strategy. It's called the 2-minute rule, and it works like this. Any task that comes your way that will take less than 2 minutes to complete should be done immediately. Don't put them on a to-do list. Don't put them off till tomorrow. Do them now. Note, the time limit strategy doesn't work just for job and chore-related tasks. I also use this strategy when I'm entering new social situations, such as going to a party where I barely know anyone, or attending an event with new coworkers, or going on internet dates back in my single days. I call it my 75-minute rule, and it's based on the idea that staying at an event for an hour is polite, but staying for just over an hour is better because it looks less obviously like a time limit. In my experience, 75 minutes is enough time to have fun and get out of my shell, and also not so much time that it's terrifying. Since we've become friends, Jolenta has also begun to adopt this rule. She's told me that it might be the best idea I've ever come up with. Another situation that chunking is especially useful in is the one I'm in the middle of now, writing a book. Being able to write a 200-page book for a respected publishing house is a huge honor, but it's also an overwhelming task. Thinking of the enormity of it just makes me want to crawl under the covers for the rest of the year and watch Laura Ingalls Wilder go fishing. But taken in chunks, it becomes more manageable. I learned this firsthand when I wrote my last book, So You Want to Start a Podcast. The book is a how-to guide, but it's also a thinly veiled manifesto about the power of individual voices and why stories matter. How would I blend all this into one cohesive book of more than 200 pages? The big picture was terrifying. First, I enlisted that mental trick of accountability to my agent, to my editor, to anyone I could think of who was counting on me. Second, I reminded myself of my other mental mantra, that done is better than perfect. Even if I just wrote stream of consciousness nonsense, it was better than writing nothing at all. Then, I moved along to actively chunking. I started with a method of chunking I haven't mentioned yet, doing the easiest or funnest part first. Jolenta is a pro at this, and I like to think I'm pretty good at it as well. For example, when I cut my fingernails, a task that I abhor because my nails seemingly grow an inch every night as I sleep, I always cut the left-hand nails first because it's easier for me to maneuver the clippers with my right hand, being right-handed and all. I then move on to the less fun task of maneuvering the nail clippers with my southpaw. In the case of my podcasting book, writing a love letter to my readers seemed like the easiest and funnest way to start. Telling people I adore them comes easy for me. Reminding people that they are unique and beautiful and worthy fills my heart with joy. Cheering is one of my favorite things ever. And so I sat down and wrote about how I believed in everyone taking the time to read my book. I told them that they had it in them to tell great stories, and I assured them that I'd give them the tools they needed to share their voices in the ways they wanted to. In addition to being fun to write, my love letter set the tone for what my book was, both a step-by-step guide and the cheering squad I believe everyone deserves. That love letter became my book's introduction. After that, I jotted down all the steps that I felt were required to make, distribute, and promote a podcast. After I deleted some and added others, there were 37 steps in total, and then I organized all the steps under 7 specific headings: dream it, write it, host it, cast it, make it, share it, and grow it. From there, the book screamed, "Write me in chunks, I'm already broken down that way!" And fortunately, the chunks were manageable. With 37 steps and 200 pages to fill, each chapter had to average out to only 5 or 6 pages. Could I explain each step in about 6 pages? I thought so, and so that's what I set out to do. Each day, I woke up and said, "You only have to write 1 step. If you write more than that, terrific. If you write less than that, at least you have more on paper than you did yesterday." Some days, I wrote only a few sentences. Other days, I wrote 3 chapters. And a lot of the time, I'd managed to write only by combining the chapter chunking strategy with other chunking techniques. For example, if I wasn't enjoying the chapter at hand, I'd jump ahead to a chapter I knew would be more fun to write, chunking for fun. Or when the idea of writing for a whole day seemed too torturous to even consider, I'd tell myself, "You only have to write for 2.5 hours," chunking with a time limit. It wasn't always easy, and it wasn't always fun. But when all was said and done, that chunking helped me complete my first draft in only 2 months. Another chunking technique I haven't mentioned yet, one that may be the easiest to start with, is to-do lists. I keep a running to-do list on my computer that I add to, rearrange, and cross things off of every day. Jolenta keeps a bullet journal that's almost the same in terms of purpose, but much prettier. The items on my list include all my freelance duties, chores, errands, appointments, social engagements, emails I need to send, and people I need to call. Some of the items are small, like text Amir to ask if he wants to have lunch next week. Some are bigger, like write the next script. But no matter what, I make sure I cross multiple things off daily. Doing that gives me a sense of accomplishment. In addition to working well with chores and work-related tasks, Jolenta and I have both found that to-do list chunking helps when we're going through a bout of the blues. Like most people, we've lost jobs and gone through breakups and dealt with tough transitions, and sometimes we're just sad for reasons we can't put our fingers on. At times like these, walking through the world as a fully functioning adult can feel impossible. And so, rather than focus on the amorphous and overwhelming work of adulthood, Jolenta and I break all the tasks of daily life into tiny chunks. Kristen, get out of bed. Well done, Kristen. Jolenta, walk to the bathroom and splash water on your face. You did it. Kristen, put on clothes. Nice. Jolenta, walk out the door. You've got this. Of course, chunking isn't perfect. As I said, even when I'm doing my best to enlist it, I sometimes don't accomplish as much as I'd like, and in some cases, it's hard to know how to break work or life down into chunks. For example, when your job is made up of a never-ending stream of redundant labor, like fast food service or cashiering, the only chunks you can really create are around break times or the hours on the clock. And even then, the work just has to get done or you'll be fired. Likewise with doing the emotional work of fixing a marriage, or caring for people who can't care for themselves, or healing your psychological wounds when you've grown up in an abusive household. So, chunking isn't a cure-all. Life has a lot of hard parts that can't be compartmentalized or broken down. Some things just have to be done slow and steady all the time, or ignored for a while, and then done all at once. But when it comes to more concrete and distinct tasks, from the stuff of housekeeping to the steps required to get out the front door in the morning, I find that chunking helps. In some cases, it makes things more fun. And above all, chunking keeps me from being so overwhelmed by all the things I can't do that it's hard to focus on all the things I can. The fact is, I can't write more than 200 pages in a single sitting. I can't deep clean my whole home in one day. And I can't transform my entire body into a temple of hygiene all at once. But I can write a love letter. I can fold socks for 3 minutes. And I can clip the nails on my left hand. And sometimes, that's enough. After many days or months, it might even add up to a complete and whole big picture.
Make friends with your body. Did you know that back in the 1400s, sailors who started seeing manatees in tropical waters thought they'd spotted mermaids? I think about this fact all the time. Not because it's a funny anecdote from history, but because it's such a glaring example of how our beauty standards have changed through time. An animal we have nicknamed the sea cow used to be mistaken for a majestic aquatic maiden. Imagine, what if the little mermaid we grew up with looked like a frickin' manatee? We'd all feel great about our bodies and our inability to magically and attractively flip soaking wet hair, which is impossible. I never thought about my body much until I turned 15 and grew boobs basically overnight. I went from mosquito bites to bigger than double D's in what seemed like 24 hours. While this may sound cool, let me remind you that naturally large breasts are very different from man-made large breasts. Real big tits are heavy and painful and turn into giant flat pancakes when you lie on your back. They aren't fun when you're 15, or at least they weren't for me. There were so many downsides that it was hard to decide which I hated most. There was the physical pain in my shoulders and back that came with carrying around my new figure. There was the difficulty shopping because nothing was made to fit people as busty as I was. And of course, there was unwanted male attention of all kinds, from strangers to my overly handsy and demeaning PE teacher. After puberty hit, I was forced to navigate the world as an adult woman, because that's what I looked like to everyone who didn't know I couldn't legally drive yet. All of this because my body randomly chose to grow big boobs. I felt like my boobs were profoundly unfair. I didn't choose to become an object of desire. I didn't mean to grow into a body that implied I was mature or ready for sex. And I certainly didn't mean to be in a body that, once it blossomed, seemed to become a blank canvas, inviting any sort of projection a man felt like seeing when he looked at me. To take back some ownership of this rogue body of mine, I tried to embrace my new figure. I went out and bought something to really express myself. And like any good teenager in the year 2000, I went to the Gap to do that. I picked out a modest, light yellow halter top with a thick strap, high neck, and built-in bralette. It was perfect. Not too much cleavage, in a color that looked great on me, and I couldn't wait to wear it. On the first beautiful spring day of the year, I finally got a chance to debut my new top. And as I ate lunch that day, minding my own business and listening to my Discman, I saw my PE teacher, This is a man who had many opinions about my body. He loved to tell me I was overweight, never going to date, and all about how he was going to help me become more desirable. All while he was touching me too much. So, needless to say, I wasn't happy when I saw him pointing and looking at me from across the room as he talked to my math teacher. Before I knew it, my math teacher was rushing toward me. "Jolenta," he said, "you have to cover up right now. That shirt is totally inappropriate for school." My heart sank. I apologized and started putting on my sweater while a wave of searing hot shame swept through my body. I had no idea I looked so horrible. But then, as I watched him walk away, something bizarre happened. On his way out, he passed a classmate of mine, Emily. Emily was tiny and skinny and maybe wore an A cup, if anything. And get this, she was wearing the same top as I was in the exact same color. And what did he do when he passed this perfect specimen of teen womanhood? He walked past her and didn't bat an eye. Didn't say a thing to her about being inappropriate or covering up. He didn't even seem to notice her. That day, it became abundantly clear to me that it wasn't my top that was offending this grown man in charge of my education. It was me. Me and my horrible, huge monster tits made a dude pushing 40 with a daughter of his own so uncomfortable that he had to tell me about it. It wasn't until the Me Too movement finally caught fire after Donald Trump was elected in 2016 that I even began to consider that I hadn't deserved the demeaning treatment I received. I thought I was supposed to pretend that all the degrading and annoying things women put up with because they are in bodies that slightly differ from those of their male counterparts were all in my head or par for the course. And often self-help books are part of the problem. The majority of self-help books out there don't encourage us to examine the damage done by the societal standards placed upon those who identify as female. The vast majority of books we've lived by don't even want us to be friends with our bodies. They veil fat shaming and unachievable standards of beauty as health and a way of life. When this way of life proves to be ultimately unsustainable, see Kristen's chapter on diets for more about this, we spiral back into the same shame and despair that prompted us to seek out self-help, and the whole cycle repeats itself. This sounds counterproductive, right? It is if your end goal is self-love, but it isn't if your end goal is to keep people buying more self-help books and wellness products. Interesting, huh? Most of the books we've lived by also don't have much to say about sexual harassment and abuse. The ones that do tend to tell victims that it's their fault for holding on to hurt and not magically willing themselves to be positive. And a lot of them don't necessarily encourage readers to embrace the bodies they have. Typical books all have pointers, tips, and guidelines on how to be accountable to your body by trying to get it healthy, aka skinny. Or they blame you for not loving a figure that society tells you is undesirable every day. What these books aren't addressing are the skewed and sexist criteria our current culture has deemed hot. These books perpetuate damaging stereotypes, unreachable goals, and self-blame for problems that go way beyond the individual. Because of this, we keep feeling like failures and keep buying more products to fix our unlovable bodies, or at least I do. I hope that someday soon we'll all laugh about how small-minded we were to give different worth to arbitrary physical traits. But until then, we have to find our own ways into loving our bodies. Because I don't know about you, but I find constantly battling my body and hating myself too tiring to keep up for the rest of my life. Luckily, throughout the run of By the Book, Kristen and I have started to notice a promising trend. More and more self-help